would play out differently. I was not aware that the Chinese had so thoroughly enveloped my battalion, cutting their communication with your people here. Hodes nodded now, the same grim expression. Said to Barr, As you know, sir, we made every effort to drive a rescue force through to Colonel McLean's command. Even with the power of the armor, it just wasn't possible to make a breakthrough. Smith watched them both, curious how they felt about the string of orders given them by Ned Almond. He tried to keep his own feelings to himself, but he knew that Barr had suffered through so many of the same meetings, had reacted with discreet exasperation to Almond's utter lack of comprehension and more, his amazing optimism that all was as he willed it to be. After a silent moment, Smith said, I appreciate the gravity of this situation. Had General Almond made the effort to understand just what was happening here? No, he thought, don't do that. They're army men. Somewhere, in some part of both men, they respect Almond as their commander. They have to. Barr looked at him, a hard stare, said, I believe you and I have always understood our combined situation, more so than Tenth Corps. There will be time for recrimination later. Right now I have most of two battalions of my command in a serious state. I saw General Almond this morning before I flew up here. Barr paused, weighed his words carefully. I was ordered to extricate Colonel McLean's command with all haste. Hodes stood, angry energy, paced to one side of the room, then stopped, looked at Barr. Sir, it seems clear from word we received through the tank radios that Colonel McLean is a casualty. Colonel Don Faith now commands the force. I have not yet spoken to him, and even if I could, I'm not sure what we could tell him. Just how are we supposed to extricate anybody? Not even an armored column can get through. Does General Almond offer us some plan? Does he have a notion of just how we are to shove aside a Chinese division so we may open up our route of escape? Barr glanced at Smith, said, Henry, please sit down. Smith let out a breath, had an ache for his pipe tobacco, thought better of it now. He liked David Barr, knew that the 7th Division's commander was already suffering under the yoke slung around him by Almond's style of command. Throughout the entire campaign, Barr had seemed a capable commander, and more, a reasonable man. But always there was the weight on his shoulders. Obedience to Almond, measured against Barr's own competence, the experience to know just what kind of strategy was called for. Hodes sat, looked at Smith, said, My apologies, sir. These are stressful times.
Neither of you owes me any apologies. Neither of you has made the kinds of mistakes that have put us where we are. I am as obedient to Tenth Corps as you are.
Barr showed a hint of a smile. Come now. Had I carried out my orders with the same precision that you did, I'd be a mess sergeant now. You wear a different hat, O.P. Almond's not quite sure how to handle you or your Marines. But if you think this latest gambit is wisdom on his part, think again.
You mean putting me in charge up here?
What would you call it?
Expedience.
No matter what happens going forward, Almond's off MacArthur's hook. If the headlines back home are bad, it's your name they'll read.
I know all of that. I'm more concerned with getting my men and yours out of this situation. Almond called me this morning, told me you were coming, of course. He also ordered me to extricate my men from you damn knee, as though he had just thought of it. I gave that order to Colonel Litzenberg yesterday, and believe me, I am well aware that if those men were here now, we would have the strength to push out toward your battalions.
Barr rubbed a hand on his forehead as though probing a headache. I appreciate that, O.P., but I've heard that the road up to Udomni is blocked, as impassable as every other road around here.
It is, completely.
So did General Almond tell you how to accomplish the withdrawal?
Of course not.
But he is optimistic that his orders can be carried out. The only avenue open to us is to fight our way through.
Barr nodded slowly.
Best of luck.
Smith shook his head.
It's not luck. It's Litzenberg and Murray and two regiments of Marines. The Chinese will need the luck.
Barr looked at Hodes, a faint smile.
Never met a Marine yet who thought he was at a disadvantage, no matter who the hell he was up against.
He looked at Smith.
I hope your pride is warranted.
It's not pride, David. It's just how it has to be. There is no alternative.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound like a recruiting poster.
Barr smiled. Every Marine does, General. I'm used to it.
Smith focused now on Hodes, could see the gloom in the man's expression.
No matter what Ammon's motives were, he's put Colonel Faith's men under my command. That doesn't mean I can do anything about it right now, but I have notified the Air Wing to give you their full cooperation. I assure you that will help. It's likely the bombers can open up some gaps, eliminate the enemy roadblocks, and give your men some openings they can use. If your men can fight their way down the reservoir during daylight hours, the air can continuously support them and keep the Chinese mostly at bay.
Smith knew what was coming. Barr said, "And at night?"
Smith hesitated. "For now, they're on their own. I'm sorry, David, there's nothing else we can do."
Hodes stood again, walked to the covered window, faced the wall, hands on his hips.
"I was so very close. It's only a few miles. They might as well be trapped on the moon. Don Faith is a good man. If there's any way for him to blast through, he'll find it."
He turned, looked at Barr.
"But how do we tell Faith that he's on his own, that no reinforcements are coming? He won't know how to drive back this way."
Barr rubbed a hand on his chin, said, "I'll tell him. He should also be told he's now attached to the Marine Command. He'll have to know to make use of the air support.
OP, might I make use of one of your helicopters?"
Smith was surprised, said,
"Of course. What are you going to do?"
"I'm going to go see Colonel Faith. He has to be made aware that we are working on this end to do all we can to get his people back down here. And he's my officer. He's not responsible for the mess he's in. Someone should make sure he knows that."
Smith stood outside the command tent, endured the blasting wind, watched Barr's helicopter rise slowly, easing into a slow turn to the northeast. He fought the blinding frost in his eyes, watched the chopper for as long as he could, the craft moving out directly over the frozen reservoir, the pilot keeping as far as possible from the Chinese in the hills. He still marveled at the helicopters, the odd tool now so terribly useful. What would we have done with those things, he thought, if we'd had them in the Pacific? Just moving the wounded. How many lives might we have saved? Now a division commander is able to fly out to a trapped battalion to give them instructions face to face.
He looked toward the construction site, the heavy equipment still working on the runway, no matter the nightly attacks by the Chinese.
We need nearly 8,000 feet, he thought. So far we've got 3, maybe. The Chinese are watching, and surely they know what we're doing and what a workable airstrip will mean. If I was their commander, I would assume reinforcements would be the first priority. Maybe he thinks about our wounded. My priority. Or maybe not.
He looked toward the east hill, the chatter of machine gun fire coming in short bursts, hints of smoke rising from the many hidden places where the Chinese were still battling to shove Ridge's fire teams completely off the hill. Bowser was there now, bundled in his coat, said,
"He get off okay?"
"Yep. Hope he gets back in one piece."
"You'd have to explain that to General Almond if he didn't."
Smith ignored the comment, said,
"We need that hill.
Ridge doesn't have the manpower to do what's necessary. That vantage point puts this whole place within the enemy's mortar range. If they had artillery, this position would be useless. Bowser moved his legs, slowly marching in place. Anything you need out here, sir? Smith turned, saw Bowser's bright red nose, the frost accumulating around his nostrils. Yep. Springtime. Let's go inside. Hagaru Ri, November 29th, 4 p.m. Bar had returned, the man in a more dismal mood now than before he left. They're in trouble, O.P. They've already taken a hell of a pounding and expect more. The enemy has them boxed in pretty tightly. Faith says the last order he got from 10th Corps was that he was to continue his attack. That was yesterday. He's pretty certain Colonel McLean is dead. McLean disappeared in an advanced position, engaging the enemy. Smith saw Hodes rise, pacing again. Engaging the enemy? Why? Barr looked down. No idea, but Faith has control as much as anyone can. Barr paused, looked at Smith. The concern is the quality of the men in that command. Hodes reacted with a sharp turn. What concern is that? These are good men, sir. Barr held up a hand. At ease, General. The fact is, a good percentage of the men in those battalions are undertrained. Most have never been under fire before. Faith is very well aware that his primary mission, McLean's primary mission, was to hustle along as quick as possible so they could piss in the Yalu River. No one was told to expect the Chinese to swarm around them like a cloud of hornets. Smith held his words, thought, did they not observe the hills? Surely the Chinese were watching every move they made. Barr shook his head, kept his stare toward the floor. Colonel Faith has every confidence that he can fight his way south. It's barely 5 miles, as I understand it. They can certainly make the effort to improve their situation. Faith understands that nothing can come up from this way. He also appreciates your sending him air support. Barr paused. It's not all roses. Faith didn't temper his opinion of the Catoosas. There's 50 or so attached to each rifle company. They've never made a fight yet. They see the Chinese and disappear into the mist. Now there's no place for them to go, but that doesn't stop them from throwing down their arms and curling up in a damn ball. It was one disadvantage Smith had been able to avoid. The Korean augmentation troops to the U.S. Army were mostly South Korean civilians, many of them grabbed forcefully off the streets of Seoul or any other place where the Korean government could find them. Now they were to fight alongside their American allies, presumably relying on a fiery passion for defending their country. But there had been very little fire in those men at all. The poor fighting quality of the fully trained South Korean divisions had already been experienced by Walton Walker, those divisions the first to flee from the Chinese assault north of Pyongyang. But the Catoosas had no training at all, and their presence did nothing for the morale of the American Army troops, whose own confidence was shaky at best. Smith knew what Barr was suggesting, and what Faith was clearly expressing, that if a sizable percentage of your rifle companies simply melted away, it would be difficult at best to keep the rest of your men from catching the same disease. Smith said nothing, had been fortunate to experience only the added presence of the Korean Marines. Those men had been a pleasant surprise, extremely well trained, with the kind of esprit de corps that rivaled the Americans. Now those Marines were farther south, holding fort alongside the American 3rd Division, spread over the countryside near the North Korean ports. Smith looked at Hodes, still pacing slowly, knew he was in a delicate place. The rivalry between the branches was always there, regardless of the personalities of the men involved. Barr would never allow that to intrude, not when the situation was as grave as this one. But Smith could see the pride in Hodes's expression, combined with the man's frustration that he had failed to rescue his men not once, but twice. Smith waited for Barr, who seemed lost in thought for a long minute. He looked up at Smith now, said, "I've never been in this situation before. O.P., I'm not a combat leader. I've served as chief of staff for some good people, and when they named me to command the 7th, I was chief of personnel for the Army Ground Forces. But I never led those men into a fight. I never had to tell one of my officers, 'Yes, I know you're surrounded by the enemy, and there's nothing I can do to help you. You're on your own. Best of luck.' You know what it felt like to board that helicopter and just fly off? I couldn't look at them. All those faces staring up at me." Barr put his face in his hands. Hodes, staring again at the wall. Smith wanted to give them something. Any kind of words. But there was nothing there. "It's combat," he thought. "Men will die. My men? Yours? Theirs?" He stood slowly, ignored his own rules, picked up the can of pipe tobacco, pulled the pipe from his pocket, filled it. He thought of apologizing, that treating himself to something he enjoyed was somehow inappropriate. The pipe was full, ready for the lighter, and he waited, the room silent. And now, a sharp knock on the door. He jumped at the sound, stuffed the pipe back into the pocket, said, "What is it?" The door opened slightly, the face of Sexton. "Sir General Ammon's observation craft has just landed. They radioed he was coming in a few minutes ago." Smith stared at Sexton, had nothing to say, thought, "It just gets worse." "I want them brought down here with all haste. All haste. The battalion, that fellow up there, Faith, I want them pulled out as well. We have to remove ourselves from this problem, and I want that accomplished yesterday." The tent was bulging with men, Smith's staff still at work, no one accomplishing anything beyond their discreet listening to Ammon's bluster. Beside Smith, the two army generals sat in front of Smith's own senior officers, all of them summoned to hear what Ammon had to say. Ammon seemed to work at catching his breath. "This morning I was cornered by those damn newspaper men. I told them we had whipped the North Koreans completely, but that the action now ongoing is an entirely new Chinese development. But I will not allow those pen pushers to paint anything we're doing in a negative light, so the rest is up to you. Smith, bring your people out of Udomni. I want a plan put on paper for the evacuation of the army forces on the east side of the reservoir. I want to know when that blasted airstrip will be complete so that we may begin moving your wounded and your most vital equipment out of here. We must evacuate your entire force down to Ham Hung. Supply will make large-scale drops, delivering to you everything you would require along the way. This means you may leave behind and destroy the greater part of the equipment you have now. Travel light, gentlemen. Make speed." Smith had gone back to his quarters, Ammon and Bowser following at Smith's request. Ammon had seemed to calm slightly after his energetic orders, and Smith rolled the man's speech through his brain, sorting out what might actually be realistic. "General, perhaps we should move into the back room. Alpha, gather up the chairs." Bowser moved quickly, the three chairs placed opposite each other, Bowser keeping his own a bit farther from the other two. Smith pointed and Ammon sat, slapping his hands on his knees, a show of nervousness.
"I hope I was clear, Smith."
Smith sat, thought of the pipe, scolded himself. "No."
"General, you have insisted all throughout this campaign that we move in haste. Had we done so 2 weeks ago, it is likely my division would have been destroyed. As it stands now, that is still a possibility, but I believe we are moving in the right direction. The speed with which we move will be governed by my ability to evacuate my wounded, including those that will be brought down from Udomni.
Once that is completed, we will fight our way out of here, and I will require the equipment we now have on hand, including trucks, jeeps, tanks, and anything else that will aid our operation. I will do my job the best way I know how. It will be dark very soon. You should get to your plane. Do you have any other instructions for me?" Almond's mouth was slightly open, and he shook his head slowly.
"No, I think you have it under control."
He seemed to blink at a new thought.
"Oh, yes, the plane. Good idea, yes. I should be off. Godspeed, Smith."
Almond stood, moved out into the larger room, his aide there now, holding open his coat. Within seconds, Almond was out the door. Smith retrieved the pipe, still full from earlier that afternoon. He flicked the lighter, the aroma engulfing him, warm and wonderful. He looked at Bowser now, was surprised to see a wide smile.
"What?"
"You are my favorite commanding general, you know that? I've had a couple of others, but none of them—"
"Oh, shut up."
Bowser chuckled now, and Smith jabbed the pipe into his teeth, said, "He comes up here all full of beans and orders us to move with lightning speed backwards. He gives us a wave of his hand and expects everything to happen as he describes it." Smith heard an aircraft, glanced up, and Bowser said, "He didn't waste any time. I don't guess his pilot likes flying around North Korea in the dark." There was a chattering roll of fire, machine guns, and Smith moved out quickly into the larger room, the cook and his aide dropping down to their knees.
"Sir, that's close. Be careful."
More firing came now, another direction, the heavy thumps from incoming mortars. Bowser was there, beside him, said,
"They're coming again."
Smith strained to hear, said,
"Maybe. Could be probes. It's not late enough for a full-on assault."
The chatter blew past him now. A splinter of wood from the wall, the clank of metal, pots on the cook stove tumbling to the floor. The cook yelped, and Smith ducked down, Bowser flattening out to one side of him. Now another round burst through the wall, another ricochet, the cook shouting out some kind of curse.
"Easy, son. Stray rounds. You two, grab your weapons. Find Lieutenant Griggs. If they need you on the line, he'll tell you."
The cook sat now, held up a wet pot, a ragged hole through the sides.
"Your dinner, sir. They busted up your cooking pot."
Smith listened, more firing farther away, the steady rumbles he had heard all day from the East Hill.
"I'll manage. Go."
The two men scrambled across the floor, coats snatched down from hooks on the wall. Smith looked at Bowser, said,
"You all right?"
Bowser sat up, wiped a hand over his mussed hair.
"Too close. Only casualty here was my dinner, Colonel. If you wish, grab a carbine. My 45 is in my bag."
"Not funny, sir."
"I've been under assault before, Colonel. It's never funny."
Bowser crept toward the door, eased it open, the cold air immediate. He closed it again, said,
"Looks calm. Most of the firing is to the east."
"I hear it."
"Well, sir, at least you don't have to prove your point to the army. If they've got any doubts whether you can spare anybody to rescue their people, a nice attack from the Chinese ought to convince them we need every hand right here."
Smith stood, eased the ache from his knees, moved toward the stove.
"General Barr doesn't need convincing. Hodes is feeling this in some place deep. Nothing I can do about that."
He thought a moment, said,
"We've got a Marine air controller out that way, right?"
"Yes, sir. He was left up there, back when Murray pulled out, when the Army boys moved up. Captain Stamford, Ed Stamford, good man."
"I hope so. The air cover might be the best chance those boys have."
Bowser was serious now, said,
"You think they're in real trouble? That's near 3,000 men.
Smith listened again to the firing, a spray of mortar shrapnel dancing on the roof above him.
"Colonel, we might all be in trouble. But I'd rather be here than out there."
Hagaru Re, December 1st, noon. 600,
A few more. It's not good, General. Something has to open up quick, or we'll lose a good many of them. Smith knew that Herring was never a man to exaggerate, and he had seen the hospitals himself. I know the situation, Doctor. How much longer, then? You can only keep a man on morphine for so long. The plasma we have is just about worthless. Sir, Herring paused, seemed suddenly emotional. If we can't evacuate these men in the next 24 hours, I heard you, Doctor. Smith couldn't be angry, knew that Herring was as dedicated a healer as any medical man in the service, but the daily frustrations were still building. No different now than yesterday, the day before that. Herring seemed resigned to his situation, said, I should return to the hospital. A few of the Royal Marines got hit this morning. Some of them took some white phosphorus wounds. Not sure they'll survive. Smith nodded, a feeble wave of his hand. Dismissed. Just keep doing your job. I'll do mine. Herring turned, left the room, and Smith heard the others in the larger room, a small group of officers, daily reports still to come. He waited for the sound of the door, Herring's departure, tried to find some comfort in the pipe in his mouth, the tobacco growing bitter. He listened to the talk among the officers, a tone of doubt. Anxiousness spread all through them, worse now than any day before. His order to Litzenberg had been finalized, the command for the units at Udomni to commence their breakout early that morning. He had heard nothing since, didn't expect to, unless it was bad news. No, he thought, they'll do it. It's one road and a dozen miles, and they're Marines. This isn't some idiotic order tossed their way by a crowing peacock in Tokyo. They're my men, and I need them here. They need to be here. It's that simple. He stood, nervous energy, paced slowly, the tobacco not helping at all. Outside, a distinctive voice. His chief of staff, Colonel Gregon Williams. Bowser was there as well, always there. Both men doing their own jobs and the duties left behind by Eddie Craig. This will kill Eddie, he thought. He'd want to be right in the middle of the mess, just like Bowser. This might be the toughest assignment most of these men have ever had, ever suffered through. Well, maybe. Hard to ignore what we had to do against the Japanese. How different is it now? A fanatical enemy hell-bent on wiping us out. Nothing new there. The Chinese probably think the same thing about us. Sir, Colonel Drysdale is here. He asked if he could see you. Smith saw a smile on Sexton's face. Felt it himself. By all means, send him in here. We have any tea around? Sexton still smiled. He brought his own, sir. Sexton backed away, and Smith couldn't avoid a lift to his spirits. Had come to like Drysdale as much as he already respected him. Drysdale was there now, and Smith was surprised, the man's uniform perfect in every detail, the wounded arm bandaged as neatly as the man's attire. Smith couldn't help a smile of his own. Come in, Colonel.
Thank you kindly, General. I shan't take up your time. I do wish only to report that our efforts to drive the enemy from East Hill have been mostly frustrated. Difficult terrain, to say the least. The enemy's artillery, what there is of it, is tossing some rather nasty stuff our way.
I heard. White phosphorus.
Quite so. My men will never complain, sir, but I must speak up for them when I say we have some rather awful injuries. I understand there can be little assistance for our attempts, and your medical people are doing a bang-up job. But I admit to having a weakness for the suffering of my men, when I see little point to it.
There is a point, Colonel, I assure you. East Hill is a key to our position. I have seen very little of the enemy's artillery in action, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have any. If they suddenly bring up some heavy stuff, East Hill is a perfect location for it. This base becomes indefensible. Even if we can't remove them from the hill itself, we must keep them engaged. Let them know we won't let them have the place free and clear. I'm sorry for your men, but frankly, Colonel, every unit in this command is suffering.
If not the wounds, then the cold. I'm not telling you what you don't already know.
I'm not questioning your command decisions, sir, I assure you. I understand the logic of your tactics and what we are being asked to do. I only wanted to inquire if there might be some relief in the offing, some way to deal with the rather terrible condition of my wounded.
Smith said nothing for a long moment, gave up on the pipe, pulled it from his mouth, wrapped the bowl on the arm of the chair. He saw Bowser now, peering into the room, thought, something else.
What is it, Colonel?
Bowser stayed beyond the door, said,
Intel report, sir.
Anything new?
Bowser moved closer, a glance at Drysdale, said,
More like confirmation, sir. Colonel Holcomb reports that it is definite that we are facing 6 full Chinese divisions.
In total?
That's just around Hagaru Ri. There's an estimate of 5 more at Udomni, possibly as many as 3 up the east side of the reservoir. Colonel Puller has not yet made an estimate to our south, sir.
Thank you, Colonel. Dismissed.
Bowser backed away, and Drysdale smiled. A surprise.
If I may offer, sir, this seems rather a sticky one.
We're still here, Colonel. The enemy is still on the outside looking in. When the 5th and 7th push their way down here, we'll have plenty of strength. Nothing the Chinese have shown us changes that.
Drysdale rubbed his chin, nodded.
I admire your confidence, sir. I share it, actually. I haven't often had the opportunity to stand alongside Yanks, and I admit there are some rough edges that are difficult for my men to accept.
Such as?
Drysdale seemed to welcome the opening.
I don't mean to sound critical, General. Certainly not. But throughout the night, your engineers take delight in illuminating the entire landscape while they labor on that airstrip. Invites fire in a reckless sort of way, I'd say. I do understand the urgency, of course.
He paused.
I also appreciate the luxury of having adequate supplies of ammunition. But I must point out, sir, that your men seem to delight in filling the air with lead. I have always taught frugality, conserving one's ammunition as long as necessary. Your machine gunners and those marvelous BARs, they do offer quite a show. I just wonder how useful that truly is, spraying 10,000 rounds to ward an enemy platoon when a few dozen would do the trick.
Smith sat now, could feel Drysdale's energy rising.
What else?
Well, sir, I don't wish to risk offense, but we pride ourselves on our deportment, the taut ship, so to speak. It is standard practice for our men to shave and tidy themselves up as much as possible every morning. I have observed very little of that among your Marines. Every man wears a stubble of whiskers, and when any of my chaps mentions it, the response is rather boastful on your part, as though the rough edges are a source of pride.
Smith lowered his head, a smile breaking out.
Colonel, I do not question your methods. I would only say that my men are less concerned with appearances. Cleanliness doesn't make them any tougher.
Certainly not, sir. I intend no insult at all.
I know you don't. I would only suggest, Colonel, that when this war concludes, and I assure you it will conclude, that these men will return home to their wives and mothers, and there will be shiny cheeks and enough sparkle to go around. As long as your men make the good fight, you may certainly attend to your command any way you see fit. I can also assure you that when it comes to priorities right here, we are pushing hard for morphine and bandages. The soap can come later.
The jeep rolled closer to the first large dozer, stopped, the crew working beside the big machine halting, watching as he climbed out. There were the usual salutes, but Smith wouldn't interrupt their labor, moved past, toward the next machine, saw men standing together, a cluster of heavy coats. They parted slightly at his approach, and Smith searched the faces, the scattering of ragged beards. Couldn't help thinking of Drysdale. Beards are warmer, he thought. Should have told him that. He saw the face he sought, the hood of the man's coat pulled back. No salute. The appropriate response, so close to enemy eyes.
Welcome, sir. Good day for working.
Smith looked past the man, the surface of the airstrip spread out far to one side.
Colonel Partridge? They've all been good. I need to bring aircraft in here right now. Tell me something I want to hear.
Partridge let out a foggy breath, said,
We got 2,900 feet completely finished. Specs call for 5,000 more. It's only been 12 days, General.
This isn't a gripe, Colonel. A C-47 can land right now, yes?
Yes, sir, I suppose so.
This wind's tough enough. It should shorten the distance for takeoff.
That's what I wanted to hear.
Hagaru Ri, December 1st, 2:30 p.m. He watched with most of the staff, all eyes on the skies, the light snowfall not enough to hide the patches of blue above them. The winds had slowed, easing the torture from the cold, Smith straining to hear the only sound that mattered.
There!
The men around him began to point, and he saw it, clearing the hills to the south. It was a single plane, responding to his orders, the first attempt at a dry run, to test whether the engineer knew his aircraft as well as his ability to build an airport. He heard the plane's engines now, couldn't help the shaking nervousness, a glimpse toward the East Hill, where he knew the Chinese were watching as well. Beside him, Bowser said,
Hurry up, damn it, you're too good a target.
Shut up, Alpha.
He marched in place slowly, the anxiety of the moment adding to the hard chill in his legs. The aching in his knees forgotten for the moment. He watched the plane lowering, landing gear out now, sinking lower still. He held his breath, the pounding in his chest unbearable, a glance at the East Hill one more time. Still no violence from the Chinese. There were voices around him now, the men offering their own quiet encouragement toward the pilot, the aircraft, the moment. The plane drifted lower, held a few feet off the hard ground, the dull roar of the engines growing soft, the plane settling down slowly, a sudden bump, a slight bounce, the wheels now on the ground, the plane moving past the crowd, slowing, stopping, turning in place, the twin props pulling the craft closer. And now the engines were silent, the props spinning slowly, the men around Smith moving forward, chalking the wheels, gathering at the plane's hatch, happy chatter. Smith held back, his eyes a blur, the weakness in his knees spreading all through him, a hard stroke of emotion he knew he couldn't hide. He was alone now, tried to blink through the freezing tears, watched the men swarming the plane, waiting for the pilot to appear. Smith turned to one side, saw a Partridge a few yards away, the engineer watching, waiting, a glance toward Smith, a broad smile, the pride in an extraordinary accomplishment.
I believe, sir, we have an airstrip.
For the rest of that day, five more of the small transport planes made the journey from the bases to the south, each one carrying necessary supplies, each then filled to capacity with 24 of the most severely wounded men. Only one incident marred the astounding day, one aircraft losing its landing gear, blocking the runway until it could be cleared. By dark, the runs were halted, but Smith returned to his quarters with a brief stop to see Dr. Herring, sharing his quiet, joyful confidence that the wounded men would now be served. Smith knew what Herring knew, that when Murray and Litzenberg brought their units into Hagaru Ri with the enormous load of their own wounded, the medical facilities would be woefully inadequate. But their work was now made easier by the extraordinary labor of Colonel John Partridge and his engineers. The final piece of the puzzle for the medical teams was the unknown that lay out to the northeast. There the Army's beleaguered troops were already confronting a hard crisis of their own. No one at Hagaru Ri knowing yet just how severe that crisis could actually become. Near Pungyuri Inlet, Chosin Reservoir, December 1st, 1950, early afternoon. The withdrawal of the Army's 31st and 32nd Regimental Combat Teams had begun close to noon. Lieutenant Colonel Don Faith, ordering all Army units along the east side of the reservoir to assemble for a forceful drive southward, hoping to push through the enemy that surrounded them. Hagaru Ree was barely 10 miles away, though Faith had wanted to believe that either Army or Marine units had shortened that gap, pushing out to meet him at least halfway. What Faith did not know was that General Henry Hodes had given the order that the forces closest to any rescue, the men who had held to the village of Sudong Ni, be withdrawn, Hodes and General Barr believing that their position was too vulnerable and too useless to add any support to Faith's hemmed-in command. The order for Faith's men to withdraw had come from him alone, without any authority received from the base at Hagaru Ree. That would change. The order finally passed through the haphazard communication network of aircraft and tank radios, the signal suddenly clearing just enough so that Faith could understand that General Smith was now in command and that Smith had ordered Faith to do all he could to withdraw back to Hagaru Ree. By that time, Faith's men had already been in motion for more than 2 hours. They formed a convoy around a lengthy line of 30 6-bys, plus a number of smaller trucks. Most of the smaller vehicles were ordered by Faith to be destroyed, along with most of the remaining supplies and the excess clothing and gear carried by the men. The trucks were emptied of their cargo, fitted instead to carry the hundreds of wounded men, the casualties of 4 days of assaults by the Chinese. As the withdrawal began, the Chinese were clearly aware what Faith was attempting to do, the gathering of men and vehicles plainly visible from the surrounding heights. Almost immediately, mortar and machine gun fire raked the column, and as the trucks began to file out into the road, Chinese infantry moved closer, adding their fire to the assault. Very soon, the air support that Smith had promised began to arrive, 20 Marine Corsairs pouring out their fire along the road, holding the Chinese away. But the chaos and confusion of the advance under fire was made worse by one terrible accident, a Corsair dropping a napalm canister that impacted short of its intended target. The fiery blast spread out through the first ranks of the American and South Korean troops, engulfing more than a dozen men, some killed outright, the rest suffering the horror of devastating burns. The sight of the blast produced panic in the men who saw it, halting the advance as Faith's men recoiled from the scene. Some of the Americans scrambled to assist the wounded, helping them onto trucks, adding to the misery of their human cargo. But Faith and his officers pushed their men and the vehicles to resume the advance, no matter the waves of Chinese fire pressing down from all sides. For the first mile of their breakthrough from their own perimeter, the Americans were continuously supported by the aircraft, but even with the planes overhead, the column continued to dissolve into a chaotic mob. Many of the men attempted to escape the incoming Chinese fire by climbing aboard the trucks, the untrained South Koreans especially unwilling to stand up in the fight. But the Chinese would not ignore the fat, slow-moving targets, the trucks with their wounded men inside, absorbing as much machine gun fire as the infantry making their way along the road on foot. Some 2 hours after they began, the convoy reached the first major roadblock, a wrecked bridge, the vehicles forced to halt. Though some of the drivers attempted to push their way across the shallow, frozen marsh, for most of the vehicles the terrain was simply too difficult. Finally, with the Chinese pouring fire onto the men who gathered near the bridge, a single-tracked vehicle was put to use, towing the trucks across the marsh one at a time, a process that took the better part of 2 hours. When the column was finally able to get underway, it was nearly dark. With most of the column now in complete confusion, the Chinese began to press their advantages, pushing up closer to the flanks and rear of the march. The darkness meant the end of the air support, and with the Corsairs now unable to assist, the increasing pressure from the Chinese pushed Faith's men into further chaos, most of the column now completely disorganized. Though some of the trucks continued to roll, the Chinese had effectively targeted the truck drivers, the sudden breakdowns requiring some of the Americans to demonstrate an astonishing brand of courage, climbing up into the driver's seats, knowing they would likely be the next casualty. But the greatest obstacle lay still to their front, Hill 1221, which anchored the strongest Chinese position yet alongside the reservoir. As the convoy rolled up, the infantry, who could still advance, began to scatter, some men pushing their way up the hill itself, leaving the road and the vehicles behind. Some men reformed into small groups, some were alone, all of them climbing up through the darkness, some confronted by Chinese machine gun fire, others slipping undetected past Chinese positions. Despite the best efforts of several officers who attempted to organize a strike at the roadblock itself, most of the men had absorbed all the horror they could take. Adding to the pressure from the Chinese closer to the road, Faith's rearguard troops, assigned to keep the Chinese off the tail of the convoy, completely broke down. Many of those men rushed forward, adding to the chaos around the trucks, many more seeking escape by climbing up away from the road. With nothing to hold them back, the Chinese pressed hard into the rear of the column, swarming around the stalled vehicles. At the roadblock itself, Colonel Faith and several of his officers, including a number of badly wounded men, succeeded in gathering enough troops to drive the Chinese away. With the road now open, many of the trucks continued on slowly. As they reached yet another destroyed bridge, the Chinese pressed even closer and in greater strength, many Chinese troops continuing to reach the trucks themselves. The casualties continued to mount, some of the wounded in the trucks now helplessly exposed to Chinese grenades and close-range rifle fire. As he continued to lead his men through the relentless gauntlet, Colonel Faith became one more casualty, taking a deadly wound to the heart from a Chinese grenade. He died in the cab of one of his lead trucks. By full dark, it was over. Some of those who survived crossed over or around Hill 1221, linking up with others, all of them walking or staggering toward the perimeter at Hagaru Ri. Others made a different escape, a desperate gamble as they walked out onto the ice of the frozen reservoir, taking aim at the glimmer of light reflected from the engineers still working their heavy equipment on the airstrip. Though many of the wounded men in the stalled trucks were pulled out, most of those could not walk on their own. With no one remaining to help, many of those men had no choice but to remain along the base of Hill 1221, only to succumb to their wounds, the cold, or the Chinese who found them. In the trucks themselves, those still alive were virtually indistinguishable from those who had died along the way. The men often stacked three deep. After rifling through the trucks for anything worth salvaging, the Chinese troops burned the trucks and the bodies of the men still inside. Throughout the next day, and for 3 days after, the survivors of Task Force Faith straggled into the Marine lines at Hagaru Ri. The Americans had left behind every vehicle, every piece of equipment, including every heavy weapon, and most of the small arms carried by the troops themselves. Though approximately two-thirds of Faith's men eventually reached Hagaru Ri, the majority of those were wounded, many severely. Roughly 1,000 men did not survive. Their bodies never recovered. Chapter 31. Riley. Fox Hill, December 1st, 1950, 1:30 p.m.
Damn, I'm hungry.
He tried not to do that, his exhaustion scattering his thoughts out in every direction, but the hollow cave in his stomach was worse today, the supply of sea rations non-existent. His hands were clumsy, stiff, the gloves shredding more each day, the biting cold in his fingers making the work all that more difficult. Riley unrolled the wire, K Kane and Morelli holding the other end of the spool, Riley trying to keep his footing in the snow as he backed slowly along the face of the hill. He couldn't keep the thought away. Worse with every step, the hollow rumble down low, a twisting ache that now stopped him, the pain in his stomach growing.
Damn, I'm hungry.
Higher up the hill, Lieutenant Goolsby watched them, offering instructions no one really needed.
That's it. Spread it along that rise there. Stick it in the snow.
The spool emptied, and Riley dropped to one knee, jabbed the steel stake into the ground. No penetration. He tried again. No strength in his arms. The stake ripping a fresh tear in his glove. He looked at his hands, dark red fingers poking through, and he tried to curl them, too numb to feel the pain. He sagged, the weakness overwhelming him now, heard Welch just behind him.
Hey, wake up! No time for taking a nap. That sniper jackass might decide to try again.
Riley tried to stand, his knees stiff, no feeling in his feet, and he stumbled, fell forward on his hands. Welch was there now, his voice hollow, distant.
Hey, LT! I'm hauling him back to the hole.
Riley felt Welch's hands under his arms, tried to stand, his feet floundering, trying to find the ground. The harder pain came now, a cramp in his gut, and he moaned, the cramp pulling him into a curl. Welch kept his grip, Riley's coat slipping upward, and Welch bent low, shouted into his ear,
"Stand up, damn it! Do it!"
Riley tried to see through the fog in his brain, his eyes nearly frozen shut, the numbness spreading, a sharp punch striking him from behind.
"Wake up! Jesus! Let's get him to the hole. There's a can of Sterno. We can make some kind of fire, maybe melt some snow."
Riley found his feet, a beehive of stinging pain spreading up through his legs. He blinked hard. The ice stuck painfully to his face. Tried to speak, his knees curling again, the cramp still pulling him down. He fell from Welch's grip, dropped hard to his knees, the cramp churning harder, and he vomited, grunted a hard cry, gasping for air, nothing at all coming out of his stomach. He cramped up again, another dry heave, felt the sobs overtaking him, and he rolled to one side, tried to wipe at his eyes. He was lifted again, more men, his arms stretched over shoulders, his feet dragging the ground, the hillside a blur of white. He heard a voice, Goolsby.
"Take him down the hill, Sergeant. We'll finish here. Sterno's not going to fix him. If you see a corpsman, drop him there. We need hands up here if we're going to get all this wire strung."
Welch was close to one side, and Riley started to protest. No.
No.
But the grips were firm, his weakness complete, agonizing helplessness, the worst pain still in his gut. They carried him for what seemed like miles, his mind drifting away, a flash of awareness, the cold, the stinging pains, the churning sickness inside, and gone again, soft sounds, blindness, his eyes frozen shut.
"He's okay. He needs food and water more than anything else. Body can't function without fuel."
Riley was awake now, blinked, a warm cloth covering his eyes.
"What happened? I can't see."
The cloth was removed, and he fought for his vision, figures above him. He tried to rub his eyes, felt a hand on his wrist, stopping him.
"Nope, don't do that. Skin's raw. It'll only hurt worse."
Riley strained to see the faces, caught the smell, familiar now, the same he had smelled for days.
"What the hell is that stink?"
He heard a chuckle, his eyes clearing, realized it was Welch.
"It's you, you moron."
Riley recognized the doctor now, another corpsman standing beside him, and the doctor said,
"Actually, it's all of you. This is what happens when you warm up a little. First order I'm giving when we get out of this mess is every man in the company takes a shower, scrub brushes, maybe with bleach. Every man who comes in here brings his own smell with him."
Riley tried to see the faces. Next to Welch, the kid.
Morelli. He had a burst of panic now, said, "Am I hit? Oh, God, my feet!" He tried to rise, Welch leaning down, a heavy hand pressing him back to the cot.
"Knock it off, Bozo. You're not hit, just loony. And you still got your feet. That's the only part of you that's not screwed up. The kid and I dragged you down here, and you were dead to the world. Thought maybe you took the easy way out."
The doctor said, "It's not all that bad, son. I'm seeing a fair amount of this. You just need something inside of you. Be grateful that's all it is. Plasma's gone. You don't need morphine. I can't explain why we haven't received any rations from all those ammo drops. We've got a few cans left for emergencies. Here, eat this. Slowly. No gulping." He saw a spoon coming closer, smelled the sugar sweetness of the fruit cocktail, opened his mouth, the syrup overwhelming him. He choked, sat up, coughed the fruit out, and the doctor said, "All right, too much. Sergeant, can you or your buddy keep at it? He needs to eat something, and this is the best we've got. I've got people who need me." The doctor moved away now, and Riley lay back heavily, felt the softness beneath him, glanced to one side.
"Christ, I'm in the aid station."
Welch knelt beside the cot.
"It ain't Honolulu. Here, eat this crap. It's better than the rest of us are getting. We ran out of anything but Tootsie Rolls this morning, and they're being pretty stingy with those."
Welch pushed the spoon to his mouth, and Riley took a long breath, tried to relax, opened his mouth. The fruit was intensely sweet, but he held it in his mouth, warming it, then swallowed carefully.
"Not bad, Sarge. More?"
Welch offered another spoonful, Riley taking the fruit easier now. Above him, Morelli said,
"Holy cow, Pete. We thought maybe you'd gone around the corner or something. You was puking and nothing was coming out. You scared hell out of me, that's for sure."
Welch fed Riley another spoonful, said,
"It's around the bend, you idiot, and he's been out there for a while now."
He fed Riley again, said,
"You'll be fine. We're all in the same fix. Just you had to be the first to get waited on. You ever tell anybody I did this for you, and I'll stick my boots where the sun don't shine." "That's it. No more. One can is all they could give you."
Riley savored the last of the fruit cocktail, wiped his tongue all across his teeth. He flexed his toes now, realized he had nothing but socks on his feet.
"Where's my boots? You sure I'm not hit? I remember puking."
Welch held up his boots.
"Right here. They got you fresh linings, some dry socks. We were stringing the wire we got in that last airdrop. Captain thinks it'll slow down the chinks next time they come at us."
"And I just passed out?
Hell if I know. I thought you'd curled up and died."
"How long I've been here?"
"An hour. Doc cleaned up your face. You're going to lose maybe a piece of your nose, tops of your ears. He says we might all get that way. Frostbite's not particular, kind of like bullets, but your feet work just fine. As soon as you feel like getting out of this lap of luxury, I need you back on the hill. So how about right now?"
Beside Riley, a voice, a heavy New Jersey accent.
"I kind of like some of that fruit cocktail. Maybe some beef stew? I'm starved."
Riley tried to recognize the voice, saw Welch looking over toward the next cot. He pushed himself up on his elbows, the man wrapped in his sleeping bag up to his neck.
"You're Caffaroni. Caffaretta. Hector. Hey, I remember you. We shared a hole up there a couple nights ago. So, all you did was puke and they hauled you to a damn bed?"
Riley began to feel creeping embarrassment now, said,
"I guess so. Ran out of gas, maybe. This here's my Sarge, Hamp Welch. The goofy-looking kid is Morelli, from your part of the world."
Welch said, "Hey, I heard about you. Your buddy Benson came back up on the line. Said you put up a hell of a fight. The first night out, took out maybe half a company. The lieutenant said you played baseball with a dozen chink grenades.
Caffaretta held up a heavily bandaged hand. Strike one. Son of a bitch blew up too quick. Cost me a finger or two, maybe. That ain't the worst of it. Didn't have time to get my boots on, so I fought off those bastards in my bare feet. Not good. They don't know how bad that'll be yet. They found shoes for me, but they're too small. Had to cut off the toes. I'm kind of an extra large. Riley sat up, tried to ignore the spinning in his head. He saw Caffarata's face now, the large man wrapped like a green mummy. He felt a chill, the tent not quite warm. Put a hand on Caffarata's shoulder. Hey, you take care, right? I gotta get back out there. I'd like to go with you, but they ain't letting me do squat. Riley stood, unsteady, the doctor moving toward him. You all right, son? You can stay here for a while yet, if you're too weak. Not many wounded coming down during the day. Might need the bed by tonight. Most everybody who's staying down here is in the warming tents. Riley felt Welch slide his hand under his arm, steadying him. He looked at Welch, saw concern, the sergeant's harsh crust betrayed by his affection for his friend. Riley tested his balance, stood upright, said, I'm okay now. Feel a hell of a lot better. Let me get my boots on. He sat slowly, still testing, the light-headedness clearing away. I appreciate the care, Doc, but this bed's for those that need it. He looked at Welch now. You seen Killian? We ought to check on him. Welch shook his head. He's in the other tent. Maybe later. Since you're fit, we're going to get back up on the ridge. Irish ain't much good for anything but taking up space. Riley pulled the boots on, felt guilty, thought of Killian, wondered just how bad his feet were. He saw Caffarata watching him, said, I gotta go, pal. We ain't finished the job yet. Next time I see you, maybe we'll be on some beach somewhere. Caffarata nodded, seemed to grow tired, turned his gaze upward. Riley looked at the doctor, said, Take good care of that one, Doc. We could use a hell of a lot more just like him. Fox Hill, December 1st, 4 p.m. The snow had deepened to nearly 6 inches, a soft blanket that covered most of the horror that still lay across the face of the hill. Throughout the day, the men had continued to prepare their defensive line, dragging the enemy's dead closer, creating human walls around each of the foxholes. Since daybreak, the Chinese had kept mostly quiet, the only real danger coming from the scattered snipers still positioned on the rocky hill and the other hill farther to the west. For now, their heavier machine guns stayed silent, what the Marines believed was the logical reaction to the effectiveness of the airstrikes. Riley had made the climb without help, though the weakness kept his steps slow, inspiring a chorus of playful cursing from Welch. At the foxhole, he had eased himself down, saw the faces of the others watching him, offered them a wave of his hand, no one giving him grief. He could see it in Welch's eyes, the sergeant's toughness not hiding what was going on inside him, inside all of them, the steady collapse of their energy. He was impressed by the barrier now guarding the hole, saw another row of corpses piled close in front of Welch's machine gun. The bottom of the foxhole was coated with a thick layer of fresh snow, and he squatted, scooped out as much as his fingers could hold. In front of the hole, Welch was tending to the machine gun, jerking on the bolt, firing a single round now, the new routine. Riley watched him, Welch's movements slow and clumsy, betraying the same weakness Riley felt now. From one side, Morelli moved closer, knelt low, precaution against the snipers, held out a pair of gloves.
Hey, Pete, here, use these.
Thanks, but I got some. The doc gave me a pair.
I seen those. They got holes worse than what you gave up. Here, these are practically new.
He took the gloves, looked them over. No holes, but the missing trigger finger. Where'd you get them? Morelli hesitated, and Welch turned, said,
Don't ask. Just put 'em on.
We gotta use what we gotta use.
Riley ripped his away, pulled the new gloves onto his fingers, flexed, looked at Morelli.
Thanks, kid. I owe you one.
Nah. Here, I found some more Tootsie Rolls, too. Ain't hardly nothing else left to eat. We've been checking the chink bodies, seeing maybe they got some rice or something, but they're about as bad off as we are, looks like. Go on, take 'em.
Riley accepted the gift, and Morelli slid away, Welch now looking at him.
Give me one, then you eat the rest. Now. Don't need to be carrying your sorry ass back down the hill because you're too weak to fight. The chinks are coming again tonight. Count on it. You stink as a gun crew, but you're all I got. Kane's handling his BAR by himself, and we only got 4 more rifles in the squad. Even Goolsby's learning how to shoot straight. I saw him back over the hill trying out a Thompson. He thinks it makes him look like Al Capone.
You hear anything about Lieutenant McCarthy?
His leg's busted up good. That's all I know. He's still down the hill. Heads up!
Riley turned toward the voice, saw stretcher bearers moving up, their load between them. The man's head rose, a quick motion from one hand, the men lowering him to the snowy ground. It was Barber.
Goolsby was there now, the Thompson hanging off one shoulder. The other sergeants coming closer as well, all of them keeping low behind the taller rocks.
Riley watched Barber, felt a stir of nervousness, the captain struggling to sit up, his voice weak.
Not sure I can make it up here anymore. Told the doc to give me morphine. My hip's busted up pretty bad, and they can't keep it from bleeding. Lieutenant Wright's in charge if I'm out of my head. Keep your eyes sharp. Corsairs are making one more run before dark. We've picked out a nest of those yellow bastards just below the sharp rocks on the far side of the saddle. They might be gathering up for tonight. But we need to get more aggressive, help the air boys do a better job. It's not good enough that they just shoot up the hillside and hope they hit somebody. I want a patrol to get out there and check the damage. If the enemy's still sitting in a hole, take care of them. If they're bringing up machine guns, bust them up. With dark coming, they won't be expecting us to push out there. He focused on Goolsby, fought for more words. Lieutenant, take 5 men with you. Second platoon will send some men out there as well. Wait for the Corsairs to do the job, and then move out there quick. Keep to the right of the saddle. Peterson's men will hang to the left.
Barber seemed weaker still, lay back down on the stretcher, said something to the 2 men helping him. They responded, lifted the stretcher, moved back along the hill. Goolsby dipped low, crawled forward, pushing through the snow. Said to Welch,
I guess it's your squad, Sergeant. You don't have to guess, sir. Just order it.
Goolsby nodded.
Right. Not used to it, that's all. Okay, Sergeant Welch. Pick 4 men to go with us. Pick good men, and let's try not to get lost out there.
The sound of the planes came suddenly, the Corsairs rolling up over the hill behind them, and Welch said,
Guess they set their alarm clocks. No time like right now.
There were 4 in the formation, the tails of each plane marked with distinctive letters LD. Goolsby said,
Love Dog. Lieutenant Peterson told me. Bunch of real characters. I guess we ought to lay low.
The men dropped into their holes, the planes banking sharply. A dry run straight down the saddle. By now the pilots were familiar with the lay of the land, the position of the enemy. Very little guesswork. Riley peered up over the edge of the hole, realized his hands were resting on the frozen arm of a dead soldier. He pulled back, avoided looking at any more of the man, kept his eyes on the plains. They climbed now, rolling over, coming back toward the crest of the hill, no more than 50 feet above the rocky ground. Riley watched them pass, saw the face of one pilot, the man looking down onto the Marines, his audience. The planes disappeared behind the hill, long seconds, then came back,
one at a time, straight down the saddle. The rockets came first, a spray that blew through the rocky hilltop beyond. The next one followed, more rockets, and then the single tank hung from the plane's belly, tumbling down, bouncing once on the rocks, and then the explosion, the napalm's massive fireball, the storm of flames curling skyward, swept by the wind. Riley felt himself cheering, the others around him joining in, hands in the air. The planes banked away, circling high above, and Goolsby was there, a hard shout. "Watch the fire! When it dies down, we're going!" Welch jumped up from the hole, called out along the line.
"Kane, Morelli, Norman, Riley, grenades and ammo, check it!"
Riley was not surprised by the choices, except for the kid. He knew that Welch would choose the men he had confidence in, and he looked that way. Saw Morelli fumbling with a handful of grenades, stuffing them into his pocket. No shortage of ammo, he thought. Just don't forget how to throw 'em. He climbed up from the foxhole, saw Morelli and the others doing the same, the kid looking toward him with wide-eyed eagerness. They watched the fire, the flames spread out on the far end of the saddle, growing smaller now, black smoke still flowing to the west. Goolsby was out front, rose up, the Thompson in his hands. Welch's words in Riley's head. Al Capone. Goolsby waved them forward, then launched himself out, away from the foxholes, moving downhill, the others following in line, keeping a gap between them. To the left, Peterson's men did the same, all of them pushing quickly to the saddle. Goolsby led the way down the hill, and Riley felt the weakness in his legs, jogged with the others, kept up, no one with any more energy than he had. The lieutenant led them down along the right side of the saddle, slipping through rocks, snow-covered scrub brush, stepping past hard frozen bodies of the enemy. Riley fought to breathe, icy air punching into his lungs. Caught the smell of the napalm now, stinking smoke, his breathing harder still. Goolsby raised a hand, held them up, and Riley saw him, red-faced, gasping through the cold. Goolsby pointed up the side of the saddle toward the wide crest. Small columns of smoke rising from spots of fire. He stood, waved the Thompson, started forward, and Welch was next, glancing back, sharp motion forward with his hand. They were climbing again, slow progress, the ground rough, the rocks hidden by the snow, ankle busters. Riley making careful steps, the shoe packs clumsy, unsteady. He could feel waves of warmth, the fresh stink of the napalm overwhelming, stirring the misery in his gut. He cursed himself, looked down the hill, the deep draw off the edge of the saddle, thick brush, the wooded draw where the enemy had risen so many times before. The woods were quiet, the only sound the breathing of the men, Goolsby leading them through a tall thicket, still below the crest of the saddle. They climbed farther, one man stumbling, Kane, struggling with the BAR, Welch pulling him upright, a slap on Kane's back. Riley kept his eyes on Goolsby, the lieutenant stopping, hands on his knees, then easing forward again, pushing past the ragged hedge of scrub. The others followed in turn, Riley watching everything, eyes on every rock, every tree, and cluster of brush. They were close to the smoke now, and Goolsby stopped, stood upright in the open, staring down, the smoke swirling around him. Riley felt a strange uneasiness, saw Goolsby step back, still staring down. Welch was there now, pulling on Goolsby's arm, the lieutenant staggering away. Welch leading the rest of them up the saddle into the stinking smoke. Riley followed, saw now what Goolsby had seen. The body was clad in the usual white uniform, the fire moving slowly along the man's legs, the thick quilted cotton burning like the wick of a lantern, the man's bare flesh seared black. The man's face was gone, a black, bloody smear, smoldering fire in what remained of the man's hair. He lay with his burp gun still in his hands, the gun charred, useless. Riley moved past, tried not to see any more. But there were other bodies, a cluster of half a dozen, seated in a circle down in a depression, each man bent over in a curl, cooked where he sat, hands holding still to their weapons. Up front, Welch fired his Thompson down into a hole, jolting Riley alert. Welch moved on, and Riley was there, saw the wounded man wedged in a narrow gap in the rocks. Wounded no more. The breeze rolled up around them now, the stink of the napalm impossible to avoid. One man dropped down, vomited in the snow, and Welch held up, kneeling close to the man, shouting something. Riley kept his eyes on the rocky hill. Black smoke, silence, searched for Goolsby. He saw the lieutenant, the Thompson, hanging by his side, and Welch was there. More shouts, grabbing Goolsby's coat. The first shots came from far off, the scattered machine gun fire ripping the air overhead. The response came from Peterson's men, a fight breaking out higher up the saddle. Goolsby seemed to freeze, uncertain, and Welch moved up beside him, jerked at Goolsby's sleeve, said, "Let's go! They need support!" The men followed Welch, Goolsby taking the point again, finding something inside him. Riley followed, eyed Kane with the BAR, a glance between them. No words, Riley knowing that Kane had the same thoughts. What the hell's wrong with the lieutenant? The firing across the saddle increased, and Riley could see the Marines moving up in leapfrog formation, a handful of men passing the others, then hunkering down, the first group moving past. Up in the rocks nearer the tall hill, the Chinese were firing down. Peterson's men were close to them, the Chinese starting to break, scrambling up through the rocks, making their escape. Welch called out, "Take 'em down!" He fired the Thompson, too far to be effective, but Morelli knelt, anchored against a rock, aimed the M1, fired, then again. Riley huddled low, could see the enemy dropping, Morelli doing the job, Peterson's men still putting on the pressure. There was more firing from Peterson's men, aimed down to the left, a fresh fight breaking out, but it ended quickly. Shouts from the Marines. Riley saw a man moving toward them, darting quickly along the saddle, keeping low, eyes on Welch. He slid in close, breathless, said, "We've cleaned out a pocket of 'em. They didn't want to stick around. Sergeant Tyler says it'll help if you keep to this side of the saddle. Some of the chinks dropped off this side earlier. They might try to get behind us." Riley saw Welch looking at Goolsby, the lieutenant responding. "Yes, good. We'll keep an eye out over here. You boys be careful over there." The man looked at Goolsby with curiosity, then to Welch, who said, "He's the lieutenant. We'll take care of our side." The man nodded, glanced at the others, a brief recognition of Riley. "Yeah, I'll tell Sergeant Tyler you said so. We already wiped out a squad of those bastards, half frozen to death." Welch looked at Goolsby, then said, "It'll be dark in a half hour. Don't hang out here too long. We'll secure what we can here, then pull back." "The Sarge is already thinking that. See you in hell." The man slipped away, the same path back toward the rest of Peterson's men. Riley saw the black concern on Welch's face. Another glance at Goolsby. "Sir, we've got to move up, keep abreast of their position. The captain gave us a job. We're not doing a damn thing just sitting here." Goolsby seemed angry now, said, "I know what we have to do, Sergeant. Let's move out through these rocks." They dropped low, Welch pointing to the brush off to one side, the men scrambling that way. Riley pushed himself through the muddy snow, a slushy mess from the heat of the napalm, slid down into the first row of brush. The Chinese machine gun began again, far up on the rocky hill, the fire peppering the rocks around him, pinging ricochets on the rocks along the ridge. He dropped flat, the others doing the same, heard Welch, fiery anger, shouting to Goolsby,
"Get down! Keep to the cover! We can't stay here! Get down the slope!"
Riley turned his head in the snow, watched the two men, Goolsby staring back at Welch with empty helplessness. Welch moved away now, a quick check of each man, his eyes now on Riley.
"You okay?"
"Yeah. What do we do now?"
"You could ask the man in charge. We've done all we can do right here. The napalm took care of most of the chinks out here, and second platoon did the rest. Barber wanted it cleaned up. It's cleaned up. The longer we sit out here, the more chinks will figure out where we are."
"Jesus." Welch lowered his voice. "He should have shoved us out quicker, found the enemy before they found us. Tyler knew what he was doing. We got no reason to sit here."
Goolsby slid down closer, seemed to gather himself, said to Welch, "Sergeant, we still have a job to do. The captain said to check the drop area, clean out the enemy."
"Well, sir, if I may suggest, now that every chink weapon is aimed this way, how about we head back to our lines?"
Goolsby looked at the others, all eyes on him.
"I suppose so, yes."
The grenade struck a rock close beside Riley, tumbled down the hill, sliding to a stop in the snow. Riley shouted, "Grenade!" He flattened out, waited for the blast, but nothing happened. He peered through the crook in his arm, the handle of the grenade sticking up from the snow. Welch said,
"A dud, but there'll be more. Don't wait for 'em. Hit 'em now."
Welch climbed quickly up through the brush, up to his knees now, fired the Thompson, a continuous spray, emptying the magazine. The others moved up with him, more firing, and Riley pushed into the snow, his feet finding rock, climbed the embankment, saw them now, a dozen men, some kneeling, the flash of fire from their rifles, more men moving up from farther up the saddle. Grenades now in the air, a shower of sticks tumbling past him. He fired his own machine gun, heard the BAR open up, the enemy tumbling down, the image in his mind, 10 pins from a single ball. The firing continued, one rifle beside him, the clink of the clip, and Welch said,
"That's it. Cease fire. Get back into cover."
He slid down through the snow, the others doing the same, Goolsby still hunkered down in the low place.
"Did we get 'em all?"
Riley looked at Goolsby, saw icy tears on the man's face, and Welch moved close to him, grabbed the man's shoulders.
"Tighten up! No time for this. That was one bunch. There's more. Tyler's already got his men pulling back. Let's get back to the hill."
Riley looked up toward the crest of the saddle, the smell of the napalm still inside of him. He pulled a magazine from his pocket, slammed it into the Thompson, jerked the small bolt. Ready again. Welch moved along the hill below him, the others falling into line, and Welch called out to him,
"Watch our rear. They know we're here, and they're figuring out what to do about it. You see anybody, shoot everything you got."
Riley kept his eyes on the darkening sky, the ridgeline still quiet. He glanced at the Thompson, his hand tapping the pockets of his coat. "Plenty of ammo for now," he thought. "What the hell's wrong with the lieutenant? Maybe it's seeing that Chinese candlestick up there. I bet he's never seen napalm up close.